You do? Novo asked, glancing at Lucita standing beside him utterly calm, her fate entirely in his hands. Dan asked in reply, Have they taken the factory yet? No, I don't believe they have even tried. Good, we'll go there. It's more easily defended. The Soviets could destroy it with their anti-missile lasers. Not while I've got Moloch's fiancée with me. Nodding, Novo said, Then I will go there too. Get yourself home. That's an order. Before Nobuhiko could reply, Dan clicked off the phone connection and turned to Lucita. Ever used a jetpack before? She shook her head. With a grin, he said, You're in for a thrill. He led her down to one of the emergency airlocks and helped her climb into a Dayglo orange pressure suit. It hung on a wall rack next to a row of equipment lockers like a headless, empty suit of armor, the bulky jetpack and life support tanks already fastened to its back. Lucita virtually disappeared inside the suit. It swallowed her right up to the chin. Dan laughed at the sight of her peering out of it like a child wearing a grown-up's outfit. Are your hands inside the gloves? He asked. Can you move your fingers? He saw that the fingers of the gloves wriggled. Good. But my feet are not inside the boots, I think, Lucita said. That's not important. He fitted the helmet over her head as she watched, silent and wide-eyed. Then he checked out all the suit's seals and connections. The maintenance label on its left leg said it had gone through a complete inspection only a week earlier. Still, Dan took the time to check everything thoroughly. There are bold astronauts and old astronauts, he repeated to himself as he worked, trying to forget that the Russians were ransacking the station to find them. No sense doing them the favor of killing ourselves. He was less thorough with his own suit, satisfied to rely on the inspection tag. From the equipment lockers, he took a tether and clipped it from a ring on the waist of his suit to a similar ring on Lucita's. Whither I goest, so goest thou, he said, his voice sounding muffled inside the helmet. He saw her nod and heard in his earphones, Won't they shoot at us once we are outside the station? If they see us, they might. But they won't know which one of us is me and which is you. Vasily would take that risk. Dan looked at her. She was serious, but not afraid. Would you rather go back to him?
Never.
I want to be with you. Even though we might both be killed, I would rather die with you, my Yonki, than live with him. Dan felt a wave of blazing, brilliant warmth surge through him. His knees felt suddenly weak. His spine tingled. Clumsily, inside the bulky spacesuit, he reached out for Lucita and pulled her close. They could not kiss. The helmets made it impossible, but Dan held her for a long moment. I love you, Lucita, he said, and I love you, Daniel. Suddenly, the ludicrousness of it struck Dan. He laughed aloud. We must look like a pair of abominable snowmen trying to make love. She laughed, too. Do they make spacesuits big enough for two? I'll have one built, he said, just as soon as we... The laughter died on his lips as he remembered where they were and what they were facing. But Lucita seemed totally unafraid. I am ready to go with you. With a nod, Dan opened another equipment locker and pulled out something that looked almost like an old-fashioned blunderbuss. A long, slim rod with a flared nozzle at one end. The rod was taller than he was, even in his helmet and suit. Hand grips studded the upper half of its length, and there was a cluster of small cylinders fastened to the end near the nozzle. They call this a broomstick, he told Lucita, as he tapped the control pad on the wall next to the airlock hatch with his free hand. We'll ride on it faster than the Wicked Witch of the West. They stepped into the metal-walled airlock, Lucita clumping clumsily in boots that were far too large for her. Dan cycled the lock. The inner hatch closed. The air was pumped out, and then the outer hatch slid open. They were not facing the Earth at the moment. All Dan could see were the unblinking pinpoint lights of the stars, the distant eyes of heaven watching him. He heard Lucita gasp. Don't be afraid, he said, reaching for her gloved hand. I'm not afraid, she replied. It is so beautiful it takes my breath away. He smiled inside his helmet and they stepped out into nothingness. Like a swimmer, Dan kicked away from the lip of the hatch, the broomstick in one hand and Lucita in the other. He helped her to get a firm grip on the broomstick, then flicked open the safety catch that protected against accidental ignition of the rocket motor at its far end. Using the jetpack thrusters to maneuver, Dan turned himself and Lucita until they were facing the factory. Off in the distance, it hung like a floating scrap heap, all angles and projections. "To the Emerald City," he muttered, and thumbed the ignition button. The rocket flared soundlessly, and they were suddenly hurtling toward the space factory. Moloch crouched behind a flimsy partition, mentally ticking off 10 seconds. The blast came at 9, loud and sharp as an unexpected clap of thunder. He got to his feet as 20 armed soldiers rushed, yelling, into the smoke where the doors to the visitor's lounge had been blown apart. Gripping a machine pistol firmly in his right hand, Moloch followed the soldiers. Their shouts died quickly. Waving at the lingering smoke as he entered the lounge, Moloch saw that it was empty. "They've gone," said a beefy-faced sergeant. "Check the airlock," Moloch ordered. Several of the soldiers began to pull grenades from their belts. "No explosives," Moloch roared. "If the outer hatches opened to space, we'd all be killed in a flash." Ostrovsky came pounding up behind him, red-faced and perspiring. "Sir, word from the communications center. It was empty when we stormed it." His voice tailed off as he saw that the lounge was also empty. "Has anyone had the sense to check outside and see if our shuttle is still linked to this airlock?" Moloch put acid into his voice. He knew he had been outsmarted. The devils had stolen his own ship and escaped. Ostrovsky's tongue flicked across his lips before he replied, hesitatingly, I'll check on that, sir." Moloch handed him the machine pistol with an angry snort. "They've slipped out of our fingers, and probably Randolph was with them." "I don't see how—" "You were going to check on where that shuttle might be, weren't you, Major?"
"Yes, sir. Immediately, sir."
Ostrovsky scuttled away. "He's gone," Moloch realized. "I don't know how he did it, but he's escaped and taken Lucita with him." Burning with anger, he strode down the corridor toward the communications center. Halfway there, he saw Ostrovsky racing toward him, still red in the face and sweaty, but looking more optimistic.
"Sir, the Yankee capitalist is at the factory. We have picked up his communications transmissions. He is trying to contact the President of the United States."
Jane Scanwell was aboard Air Force One when the message came through to her. Dan Randolph, urgent, from the factory at Nueva Venezuela, life and death. The President was returning to Washington after a dreary, depressing campaign swing through the West. No matter where she went, no matter how carefully her aides manipulated the crowds, no matter how tightly her security people controlled her route, she still saw the gaunt, empty-eyed specter of hopelessness among the people. Hordes of unemployed, whole cities decaying, tent cities of hungry families ringed by barbed wire and hard-eyed, helmeted special security police. There were no demonstrations against her. No angry voices interrupted her optimistic speeches. She saw no rage or violence in the streets when her motorcade drove through the barren, grimy cities. She almost wished she had. The heart had been taken out of these people. Even in Salt Lake City, her own spiritual home, the people were weighted down with a sullen, unremitting despair. There was no doubt of her re-election. The opposition was scattered and weak. The people had no faith in their promises, nor in mine, Jane knew. "I'll win because they have no other real choice. And if I want to ram through a constitutional amendment that will allow me to run again in 4 years, they'll let me do that, too. But do I want to? Do I have to?" Her secretary interrupted her bleak ruminations by standing before her. He was a frail, almost effeminate young man who seemed to have an affinity for self-abasement. Jane looked up into his soft, worried face.
"What is it?"
"Mr. Randolph is still trying to reach you, ma'am. He is calling from—"
"I know where he's calling from.
But he says that the United States is being threatened by an attack, something about a strike in the Midwest, worse than a nuclear missile." Frowning, Jane snapped, "I told you to have his call channeled through state. If Dan Randolph has anything to say to me, it can go through normal channels."
"Yes, ma'am.
But they—" "State, that is. They seem to feel you ought to talk to him." Startled, annoyed, Jane swiveled her commodious chair to the curving console built into the plane's bulkhead. Through the window above it, she could see the brilliant, fleecy white of clouds lit by the sun. Down below, on the ground, she knew that the weather was wet and gray and gloomy, but up here it was a beautiful, sunny, blue-skied afternoon. "Put him on," she snapped. When Dan Randolph's face appeared on the display screen, she smiled in spite of herself. Until she saw that he was unshaven, grim-faced, and there was a very sultry-looking Latin girl standing behind him. Lucita knew that she was standing up